If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
We started to look at, well, you know, if these families are out there, if there are options for these kids to be raised in family, if there's ways that we could tap into the local community, you know, why wouldn't we pursue those types of solutions for kids?
Welcome to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a show about adoption, foster care, advocacy, and becoming the best caregiver possible. Pull up a chair. We're glad you've joined us. Here are your hosts, Mike and Kristen Berry.
Hey friends, welcome back to the Honestly Adoption Podcast. My name is Mike Berry, along with Kristen Berry and Nicole Jurgis. We are your hosts for this show, and we are excited to jump back in on our podcast series, Resources That Transform. This is part six, and in this episode, we are sharing an interview we did just last year with our good friend Brandon Stiver from 1 Million Home. 1 Million Home is an organization created focused almost solely on reunification. They are passionate about seeing children in a loving family, in their biological families, and that is their global mission. But one of the reasons why we're also featuring them in this series is that they're a partner of ours. We just partnered together along with Deborah Gray to bring the attachment and trauma-focused therapy postgraduate training program into the online space. You can learn more about that by clicking the links in our notes. But they also have launched a training portal to help parents succeed, help parents find valuable resources, which is something that's near and dear to our hearts. So we wanted to feature 1 Million Home in this interview that we did with Brandon Stiver. Brandon is salt of the earth, amazing. We loved talking with him. We've loved getting to know him over the last couple of years and also the work that 1 Million Home is doing. You guys are going to love this interview. But listen, if you are new to the show, welcome to you. Do me a favor, jump over to our podcast page, honestlyadoption.com/podcast, and you can learn more about the work we do at Honestly Adoption, as well as catch up on past episodes. And leave us a review. Jump over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, basically wherever you can find podcasts, and leave us a review. Let us know what you think about the show. We would love to hear your thoughts, and every time you leave a review, every time you leave a comment, it just sends those algorithms into the stratosphere, and more people get connected to this show. We would love for you to do that, and we're glad you guys are here. Listen, as I mentioned a moment ago, the partnership that we just formed along with Deborah Gray to bring the attachment and trauma-focused therapy into the online space has been an amazing journey. And we would love for you guys to check that out. If you're a clinician, a professional, a caseworker, medical provider, Deborah Gray's attachment and trauma-focused therapy is for you. But if you're a caregiver, we also invite you to check that out as well, because that program dives deep into the world of attachment, and it's taught for clinicians by clinicians, but it's a valuable perspective into the strategies and the methods and focus of clinicians. So again, all that's linked below in the show notes. We'd love for you guys to check that out. It's open for enrollment now. And get this, if you're a professional, you can get 46 continuing education credits by joining the ATFT. So click the link in our notes and learn more about that. And now on with the show. Brandon, welcome to the Honestly Adoption Podcast. It is so great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Mike. Yeah, great to be with you guys.
So you work for an organization called 1 Million Home. We've been excited to talk to you guys for a long time, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But I want to give you a chance to
to tell your story, what you do, how you came to do what you do. So I'll let you share that with our audience.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm the Community of Practice Director with 1 Million Home. And basically what 1 Million Home is, we are a community of practice model. So we're kind of a place where various organizations throughout the world, especially in the Global South, come together and convene around how can we promote child welfare practice that leads to permanency. So my personal background, before I worked with 1 Million Home, I've worked for a few other nonprofits. I kind of got my start when I'm a Californian, West Coast, still on the, I'm on the West Coast again now. I started off in a church service, and God, I felt, was telling me to go run an orphanage in Africa. This was something that was coming to me kind of 3 Sundays in a row, and it kind of came to culmination on Father's Day in 2007, and just really felt like, oh my goodness, I just like received my divine calling, right? And from that point on, just kind of set out that this is what I'm going to go do. And I started to pursue opportunities. I was still in university at that point. I went to a small school in Orange County, California, and started to pursue opportunities to do volunteer trips in East Africa. I got accepted to go to one in Tanzania. So Tanzania is in East Africa. For those that are not aware, it's right below Kenya, right above Mozambique. And I ended up going on a volunteer trip, and as I was preparing for that trip, I became a child sponsor, and just started to feel more and more inclination towards the vulnerability of children. This was mid-2000s, so the AIDS epidemic was still just very prominent. It's still prominent there, of course, in sub-Saharan Africa. But just kind of took what little I knew, and I didn't know a whole lot, and just kind of went full board and pursued whatever it might be that was out there for me. So I ended up being a volunteer on a couple trips, being a child sponsor, and then actually got hired to go and work at a children's home. And, this to me, I was 23 when I started working at the orphanage and felt like, oh, this is, I've stepped into my life calling. I'm still young. I don't know what that, if I peak at 23, I don't know that that's a good thing, but that's kind of how I felt, I ended up working there for a few years and worked with great people. There's a lot of orphanages out there that are really run down or corrupt. That wasn't the case here. It was a faith-based organization, and really got along with the people and really loved the kids. But after working there for a few years, started to really kind of think through, these kids, they ought to have family, and then starting to recognize, sometimes they have an auntie or someone come and visit them, they do have family in the community. So why is it that they're here of all places, right? And then we started to, as time goes on, you start to see, oh, these kids aren't necessarily doing well, or they're not adjusting well when they're interacting with their peers. So I got married halfway through that. That's a whole other story. I have an amazing wife. Her name's Melissa. We got married, we got engaged 6 weeks after meeting face-to-face. We met when I was living in Tanzania and she was on a short-term missions trip. And so it was a very successful short-term missions trip for her. She came back with an engagement. I didn't have the ring yet, but anyways. We left after 2.5 years of working at the orphanage, came back, was back in California, but then relaunched to do a family-based program for 5 years in Tanzania. And we started to look at, if these families are out there, if there are options for these kids to be raised in family, if there's ways that we could tap into the local community, why wouldn't we pursue those types of solutions for kids, right? And we could certainly reflect on kind of the systems with all their flaws around foster care and so forth, even here in the States, at least it's focused on trying to keep kids in family as much as possible. So we started to look at, you know, what can we do on that front? So we ended up running a family-based program for 5 years. So, and then now at 1 million home, you know, we get to work with organizations that are doing all sorts of amazing stuff to find permanency for kids through primarily through family reunification. And in collectivist societies, that looks a little bit different. Sometimes people would just say, if you get them back to mom and dad, then that's family reunification. But in collectivist societies, getting back to an aunt or a grandparent or, you know, that's also family reunification, especially, you know, when that's kind of the mode of family there. So, but we get to work with organizations kind of throughout the world that are doing really great work to get kids into family. And I'm just so privileged.
Thank you so much for explaining a lot of that. I'd love to break down a little bit more. What is it that prevents many children from returning to their family in the first place, whether that's mom and dad or an extended family? What is the holdup? What holds people back?
Yeah, you know, it's a complex issue, right? And unfortunately, sometimes we like to try to boil things down to be as simple as possible. So we hear something like AIDS orphan, and immediately our thought is orphan, right? And our minds go to, this is Little Orphan Annie or Oliver Twist or Harry Potter or whatever. And these kids don't have anybody in the world, you know, kind of thing. So then when we have a simplistic understanding, then we have a simplistic solution. And, you know, putting a child, especially younger children, which is not according to best practice, but to put them in long-term residential care, is a very simplistic solution. And we know people that are doing amazing work in residential care. I don't mean to demean or anything, but we really have to kind of get into the complexities. So when you ask Kristen, you know, as far as, you know, what's preventing these kids from getting into family, poverty is definitely an underlying stress factor in a lot of these communities. And because poverty is so underlying, of course, that can lead to violence in the home. That can lead to kids going to the streets because they're not getting fed at home. So they're going to try their hand at begging. Then they fall into other vulnerabilities and they become separated from the family on the street. You know, of course, you could have kids that become separated because of large crises that have happened throughout the world. It could be, you know, a famine in northern Kenya, or it could be the way that COVID protocols have been played out in certain countries. You know, those things can lead to kids becoming separated. So you really actually need a multi-sector approach to provide, you know, holistic care, both at the family level, but also at the systems level. So you have to approach it from, you know, what policies can we do that will help prevent and thwart kids from becoming separated? You know, if you go into a lot of these, you know, just to use an example from Tanzania, where I lived for several years, I could pick up the national guidelines for most vulnerable children, and it'll say stuff like children's home placements are supposed to be a last resort, right? But I know from experience that a kid could go from their family to the Department of Social Welfare and then to an orphanage in one day. So functionally, it's not actually a last resort, but that's just what the policy says. So the policy is one piece. What we focus on is what's actually going on at the organizational level, where a lot of these, and it's the same in the States. I've worked for a child welfare agency in the States as well. You know, governments rely on nonprofits to provide services, and that could be any number of different types of services. That's even more so the case where capacity is really lowered in countries in the global South that are don't have all the developed systems that we might have in the West, and those things are still coming about. So it's important for the organizations to say, what are the services that we're going to provide? And unfortunately, in many situations, the services that are provided, you just get a bunch of people that say, we want to do residential care, rather than saying, well, what's actually needed, right? Rather than doing the needs assessment in the community to say, well, actually, what this community needs is a daycare center, right? And this daycare center will allow these kids to have a safe place to stay, so that mom can go out and she can do work, and then she has income, and then the kid can stay home. So we really have to kind of look at what are the needs in the community. And if we can address those, then we will be able to do prevention. So it takes that policy level, it takes the community level, and then it takes the family level. And the family level, it really looks like, how are these individuals relating to one another? Is there anybody in the home that is potentially unsafe? Is there any recourse if there is somebody that is unsafe? And how can we make sure that people are getting along and so that kid can continue to have a right to grow up within their family?
So, man, there's just so many questions we want to ask. I think the reason, a big driving reason why we really have been waiting to talk to you guys for a long time is that what you're talking about is not something that you hear. That's not typically like the driving theme of an adoption conference, especially here in the U.S. It's more along the lines of there's X amount of orphans in the world and we all need to step up and we all, and very rarely do you hear about like family preservation, like, hey, let's take a harder look at what's happening in these countries, and ask some bigger questions, is this child technically an orphan, right? Or, should we be referring to them like that, or should we be looking at how can we reunite children with their families? It's just, it's a foreign concept, which I think is an injustice, and it's complex. So how do you guys navigate that? How does 1 million home navigate some of these complexities, especially when it comes to that rub with the what I would call the more evangelical approach to orphan care, if that makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of ways we can take that, but how do you guys navigate those complexities? Because that's a big mountain.
It is a big mountain, and I totally get what you're saying with the evangelical. Like I started, I was in an evangelical church when I felt called to go run an orphanage, right? And now that script is totally flipped. So, when we talk about orphan, right, and you hear there's X amount of orphans throughout the world, it's important that we actually understand what those words mean. So, for example, if you were to say there's X amount of orphans in the world, 10 years ago, you would have said there's 153 million orphans in the world. And today, that number is 140 million. So the number is actually going down, even just as kind of like that biggest number of around orphans, according to the UN. And yet in some places you see residential care on the rise, right? Orphanages, right? The place where we place the orphans. But it's actually really important that we understand, what this landscape actually looks like. So when we talk about orphans, so that 140 million orphans, when we hear that statistic, which comes from the United Nations, that is including what are called single orphans. So a single orphan means that they've only lost one parent, right? So most of those orphans actually still have a parent. So which just totally blows our mind in regards to what our connotation of what an orphan is, right? Because we get the picture of, may I have some more, sir, the whole Oliver Twist thing and and that's what we think of. But the truth is most orphans have family. So then when you get down to double orphans, meaning that they've lost both of their parents, that's more around 15 million. So still significant, but not 140 million. And then when you talk about kids that are going into orphanages, which is most recent reports, there was a study done recently by the Lancet Commission, where it was upwards of 6 million kids in long-term residential care, right, in the world, in orphanages. So even if you compare those, most of the kids that are even in orphanages, it's even if that was a best practice solution, it's not necessarily even hitting the mark. And then when you actually get into who are the kids in the orphanage, 4 out of 5 of them have one, if not both of their parents still alive. And the primary reason that they're there is because of poverty or because of some other family issue that could potentially be remedied with proper social work, therapeutic, and other community services. So it's actually important that we understand. And I think once we start to get to that, and then we start to ask the hard questions, you guys are parents, I'm a parent. When we think that emotional piece, right? Because especially within evangelical circles, you have to, I was a blubbering mess when I left the orphanage after my first short-term missions trip. That little boy that I sponsored, I was a wreck, and he's a wonderful little boy, just wonderful. But I was a total wreck. But who was I really? He was deaf, so he didn't really have any understanding about who I was or why I was crying or why I had spent the last 2 weeks with him. But that emotional piece is what kind of kept me going. But we actually have to find ways, how can we actually diffuse that a little bit so that we can step back and say, holy smokes, like we need to seek something better for these kids. We need to think they don't need, you know, Americans just coming in randomly or doing, you know, they need to be in families and communities just like we would hope for our own children, right? So if something happened to me, you know, I have 4 kids, 1 through adoption, 3 bio kids. If something happened to me, for certain, like they would go to their aunt or my brother and his sister, or they would go to grandparents, like, you know, like that's what I would want. So we should want that same for them. So even when we talk about the numbers,
gosh, totally.
When we say 4 out of 5 of these kids, even that one that doesn't have parents and is a true orphan, we want a family for them too, right? That's not like, oh, the 1 out of 5, they can stay. No, we want family for all the kids because that's what we would want for ourselves and for our own children.
What I love about that shift of thinking is that once we move ourselves out of the center of that conversation, we begin to see this bigger picture. And I know, you know, a turning point for me was very similar to the turning point for you. I thought, I've just got to be there. I just got to do something. I'll be at Department of Child Services at 2 a.m. and pick up this child, and I am going to save the day. Until you start to shift that thinking and you ask yourself, what would happen if? What would happen if I were in a car accident at 2 a.m. and the police showed up and they didn't know, you know, who my kids could go to and what their names were, and they were at the Department of Child Services? What would happen if we lost a job? We weren't able to provide food. Where would we go? And I know for our family, we've told a little bit of our own story, you know, through pieces of our podcast. But for us, a big shift in thinking was when Mike lost his job and we still had 6 kids at home, and having to move ourselves into that place of accepting, accepting free lunches at school. You know, I actually just sat in the office at central office and cried with this poor woman who was like, it's okay. It's okay. So many more people have been here than what you would expect. You know, having to try to get Medicaid, and we have kids with special needs and, you know, need to be in the hospital for their regular checkups. And all of a sudden we're looking at our budget and saying, we can't afford the $500 it costs just to walk into this office. I'm sad to say that it took some of those eye-opening experiences, for me to shift how I saw other people. I didn't want someone to come in and rescue my kids. I just needed some support to get to the next step so that I could provide for the kids that were already here. When you're talking about some of these prevention, you know, for us, what prevented us from losing our children during that time? It was some of the government services we were able to get. It was neighbors who just, you know, stopped by and offered emotional support or a gallon of milk or an old winter coat. You know, it was those things. It was family members who said, I know you just sold your car to pay your bills. Would you like to borrow my car during the winter to get back and forth to work? What if we didn't have that? So when we talk about prevention in the context of 1 million home, what does that prevention look like? Can you give us some examples of what that might be?
Yeah, absolutely. And your example is spot on, right? Because then we're talking about the services. When my family moved back from Tanzania, and I have 4 kids, and we went back to the Central Coast of California, which is where my wife and I are both from. If you guys know the Central Coast of California, it is expensive. It is expensive. And I was working for a little foster family agency and trying to support my, and there were times where if we didn't have WIC, we would not have had groceries. And this was just a couple of years ago, you know, so I totally hear that. Now, what's the difference? There were services that were available, right? So to liken your story and to liken my story, because we're all parents, we've all been there. We've all had those hard times where we're trying to make ends meet. And sometimes we rely on services that are outside of our own home or outside of, you know, the vocation that the parents have taken up. When I was in Tanzania, we worked with a community of church leaders. And we had talked with them about the importance of kids growing up in family, the importance of family preservation, the importance of welcoming children in to your home if they don't have a family to be with. So we had all these conversations, and we received a lot of our referrals directly from the church, right? From these different churches that we were engaged with. We had one instance where one of our pastors reached out and said, you know, we have a family in our church, a husband and a wife and three kids. The husband was working, they would wash carrots in the river, and which was flowing through this village that they lived in. And he contracted some waterborne illness and suddenly passed away. And all of a sudden you have this mother and her three children. That is the exact type of situation where those children are vulnerable to becoming separated from the mom. So thankfully we had this pastor who knew this family. So you have the relational piece right there. You have the church, which is a service in and of itself. They have a relationship with us as a service provider. They reach out to us and they say, you know, this is what the family situation is. You know, what can we do? And for us, we said, well, we're going to send out one of our staff to meet with her, to hear her story. And we're going to look at what are three ways, just like you received free food that cost somebody something, but you received it. I received it right when my family was receiving WIC. So we said, well, what does that look like for a woman who has not worked for a while? Her husband, who was bringing home money, they were still poor, but they were doing it right. And they were a good family. So we said, well, how can we provide community services to you? So we said, we're going to buy groceries for the next 3 months. So food support, just like we were discussing. She herself had previously run a small business. So we gave her capital to restart that business. And then what was the other one? We gave her money for something else too, but all of it came down to less than $200 over a 3 month period. Okay. And she was meeting with our staff who was talking with her and helping her through that. During that time, we just gave her that gap and covered stuff for a few months while she was working with her church. Her sister came from their home area, moved in with them to help with the kids so that she could go back to work, and they continue to go. Now they still have to process all the tragedy around the passing of the father. But at the very least, you know, we were able to keep that family together. So that's an example of what preservation looks like. And even from the nonprofit standpoint, you know, that cost us less than $200, and we were able to help three kids stay home, right? Stay with their mom. And if that kid were to go into an orphanage, and each of those kids, you know, there's no other services provided to that family, and each of those kids get a $50 sponsorship, that's $150 per month. And then you stretch that out over a year. So then you're talking about $1,800. And then you're talking about over a decade. Then you're talking like $18,000 or whatever it is. Like it's insane how much money we actually put into seeing kids go into orphanages, where we could actually do it a lot more cost efficiently if we just say, how can we actually help these families to access services and to get the things that they need, so that they can stay together as a family. So that's one way that prevention looks. One example out of many different potentials.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And again, it's just, I think it's something that needs to be, you know, we've awakened to family preservation. I shouldn't say awakened to it, but we have begun to put a great value on helping our audience understand that. You know, we tell people who are doing foster parenting all the time, that remember what your goal is as a foster parent. Your goal is reunification. That's why you do what you're doing right now, right? And you always have that like, wait, what? You know, like that look in their eye, like, well, wait a second, but what? I did this because, you know, I wanted to start a family. It's like, that's not why you do foster care. And we kind of get that pushback, you know, and we have to explain, like, listen, it may turn into that, right? But that's not your overarching goal. But we still feel that friction at times. And I'm just wondering, since I've been following you guys and I know several people on your staff, on your team, I've wondered about some of the pushback that you guys are getting from what I would call the mainstream adoption, you know, orphan care world, whatever you want to call it, and how you guys are handling that, you know? So, and maybe you're like, nah, we're not getting any pushback at all, but I have to believe you're probably getting like people saying, but wait a second, you know, yeah. I don't know if this makes sense or how you would answer that, but yeah. What are you guys, how have you gotten any pushback on that? Have you gotten any, sure, any negativity and, or even attacks, and how do you guys handle that?
Yeah. I mean, there's always pushback. I mean, it's 2021, right? And we have social media. So pushback is kind of the name of the game, no matter what you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah. The Facebook prophets, right? The Facebook geniuses, they know everything. They're going to tell you.
That's true. All the armchair quarterbacks. It's for sure. Yes, we do get, we can get pushback, and we're familiar with that. And look, these are complex things. We have a mission to get 1 million kids home. Like, that is literally the mission of our organization, and to do that in partnership with great organizations that are in the field, Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. We have partners in all these places, and that's actively what we're working towards. But at the same time, we recognize that, you know, residential care is a component, right? It's on the continuum. It receives way too much priority, especially in types of situations. So there's an allowance for it, but we really have to shift the way that we are, that we're working. And in the global sector of child welfare and child care, we're going, there's a big push towards care reform. So we kind of fall within that, but specifically looking at the grassroots piece. But when people give us pushback, you know, I would encourage people to check out our website on onemillionhome.com. We have some of those FAQs where people can just kind of be like, well, you know, and it's kind of like, well, what about this? What about that? You know, and you get into questions like, well, wouldn't it be better for a kid to, you know, be raised in an orphanage than to be in an abusive situation at home? And, you know, to which my response would be, well, if those are the only two options, then we've already lost, right? We have to, we can't stop.
Such a tension-filled question. Yeah. That's such a tension-filled question.
Yeah. And it's one that I get often, you know, when in those pushback, and it's understandable. Like, you have to have child protection in place. You have to have safeguarding. You have to make sure that there's good case management and monitoring of the cases to prevent those types of things. But that's no different from, you know, what you guys might see in your guys's context, or me here, you know, in Tacoma, Washington, you know, so we're trying to prevent abuse here too, but we're still trying to be as family focused as possible as the system goes. So, we definitely, there's pushback, but a lot of people are rethinking and saying, I think the bigger thing is you'll talk to people and they'll be like, well, yeah, of course family is better. But they don't see it as attainable. So actually for us, it's more about how do we get to the next step. If you're pushing back and you actually believe that it's better for a kid to be separated from family than in a family, you know, that's going to be hard for me to navigate, because to me, whether it's scripture or whether it's, you know, UN policy or just the way the system works in the US, it's all based on family. Like, that's the idea.
Yeah.
So if you are, you know, convinced that no, the best place is in an orphanage, you know, then that's tough. Most people will say, yeah, family is best, but it's not possible in our situation, or they're the exception or whatever. Look, these situations are hard. That's why we, and I come as like, I was working at an orphanage, right? So I got dirt on my hands, you know, like this is not like, there's no condemnation or anything like that. It's, hey, actually it is possible to get kids connected into family. We can help you do that. Our partners that are in the field can help you do that. And you know, that's the invitation. There's no condemnation. If people are providing pushback, it's just an open hand and say, hey, come and talk with us. Let's see what we can do together to help kids thrive in family. That's what we're all about. We want to see kids permanently in family. And we say reunification whenever possible. That is our priority. Similar to how it is what you're describing, Mike, in regards to foster care. Reunification whenever possible. adoption whenever necessary, but always family. That's our mantra.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
That's so great. And I think it really plays into that term family care, which I love so much with our background being in the foster care system, but also as a large family with children who have experienced the trauma of the foster care system and family separation. Family care to us then can mean that variety of things, whether that is that care for the family of birth, or, you know, or their biological family. So that could be, like you mentioned earlier, can we get a daycare? Is the thing that's holding everything back, this lack of childcare, this lack of means to get back and forth to work? Is it an addiction? Is there something that we can provide that will help a mom or a dad to manage an addiction and be able to be healthy at home? And then secondly, that family care for us can look like supporting the foster family, supporting the adoptive family, because sometimes we do know that kids can't go home, but that is the minority, not the majority. And once a child is in permanency, continuing to provide that family care. You mentioned a little bit the trauma, and I appreciate that you did that because I think too, when we're away from a situation, we think there are kids, they need a home. It's going to be like Annie. We'll all get together and we'll sing a song and have a musical. The truth is, when kids are living in an institution, kids are living in a foster home, kids are separated from their biological families, that's a trauma. Can you speak a little bit about that trauma that's caused within this whole system?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was, I teach a couple of college courses as well, and we were talking just this week about adverse childhood experiences. It's a really helpful framework for kind of outlining what are some of those traumas that kids have gone through. And kids that are separated from their families, they are going through those types of trauma and adversities, and it leaves a mark, like it just does. And I don't only mean a physical mark, you know, a black eye will go away over time, but the effect that it has on the kid's soul and on their development, you know, those things last a lot longer. And, you know, when a kid has been separated, we'll start with kids that are living on the street, right? Because our focus isn't like we want to reform care, right? So orphanages are a care setting, right? But we don't want to just say, well, we just need to reform that, because then we're only looking at maybe like 6 million kids. And that's if you get everybody, you know, kind of thing. What we want to say is, actually, how can we take that what people are doing here and pursuing something that they might have the best of intentions about, but we're going to reform that to get more kids home? Because you have at least 100 million kids living on the street that are also separated from family, that we need to get them home too. So for us, it's always both. It's the kids that are living on the street, and it's the kids that are in orphanages as well. We just want to go after family separation. So trauma is ubiquitous when it comes to kids that are living separated from their families. If a kid is living on the street, which is a significant population, it's much a bigger population than kids that are in orphanages. Abuse that they face, if we look at it from like the adverse childhood experience kind of framework, sexual abuse is very common. Drug abuse becomes very common. A lot of kids will take to sniffing glue, which is just a drug that just kind of numbs them. It's not like, I feel so high, you know, and this is so fantastic. It's literally like, I'm hungry, but I don't have food, but glue is cheaper. So I'm going to do that. And it's going to numb me out to the feelings that I have. But then you think, well, what is that doing to the kid's, you know, brain? Like literally, you know, their brain. So yes, they go through, drug abuse is very common on the streets. Sexual abuse, peer-to-peer especially, but also those kids are vulnerable to being sexually abused by other people just from the neighborhood, because those kids are not well protected. Of course, there's the neglect from a developmental piece. You know, my kids mature as much as possible. And the fact that they have a mom and a dad actually show them, oh, this is what it looks like to mature, right? When you just have peer-to-peer interaction, they don't have that example of this is how I mature, right? So so there's that developmental piece, right? So their development can be stunted, which is traumatic. They're going through adversity like drug abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, family separation in and of itself. You know, that's an ACEs score, like if there's family separation there. So, I mean, all of these kids are just racking up their ACEs score, right? And then when you flip that and you go to, well, what does it look like when a kid is separated in orphanages and what does trauma look like there? Well, there you're, you know, as much as we like to say, well, isn't it better, you know, for a kid to be in an orphanage than to be in an abusive family? The big thing that we're taking for granted there is the fact that abuse is actually more common in orphanages than it is in the average family. So that's actually not the argument is somewhat unfounded anyways. So yes, abuse, again, peer-to-peer abuse is very common in orphanages, sexual abuse as well. Neglect, kids get attachment disorders is very common, similar to what you can see in foster care here. And then of course, then the developmental piece is that they can start to develop stereotypies and other institutionalized behavior that is just doesn't jive. And then when those kids turn 18 and they're turned out into the world, they've been living in a totally different culture, right? Because just because the orphanage is in Africa, you know, Tanzania or whatever, that doesn't mean that they know what it means to be Tanzanian because they lived in this little subculture. So the trauma, the attachment, all of those things are very prominent when we talk about kids that are separated from family.
When children are returning home and orphanages or institutions are left, whether that's the building, the structure, the people who had jobs there, what are some ways that those orphanages or institutions can be repurposed?
Yeah, and that's core to our mission, right? Because, you know, we recognize when I talk with most people that have some sort of residential care model, orphanage, children's home, whatever, most of them that I talk to, they got into it for the best of intentions, you know, and they're awesome people, like the people that I worked with. I think the people are great, you know, a lot of the orphanages that I interacted with, these people are great. So it is just kind of saying, hey, it is possible to do something else. So what do they transition towards? One model that we really promote is to become reunification centers. We have a number of partners, including Agape Children's Ministry in Kenya, Helping Children Worldwide in Sierra Leone. Both of those have said we're going to be reintegration centers. Agape has been doing it for about a decade now, and they've helped literally thousands and thousands of kids go home because they took up the model to become a reunification center. So instead of those 88 kids day in, day out, over year after year, and all the kids are getting institutionalized behavior and trauma and all of that, they help those kids get home, and then they get more kids off the street. And you actually see the number of street dwelling children in their community, you know, decrease. And we have other friends, such as those in Sierra Leone, that are taking a similar model. So we definitely promote for people to repurpose to become reunification centers, but not everybody needs to do that. Some should transform and become early childhood education, or they could become like a social services office, you know, where they have their social workers come in and out and they're following up in the home with providing case management and child protection and safeguarding stuff. You can have some that become, you know, I was talking with one recently. They said, yeah, you know, I think what we're going to do with it, the orphanage is right next to a medical clinic and we have a friendship with those people there. So I think we're going to have it become an extension of the hospital. Hey, people need medical services. Why not? You know, so there are really a lot of different ways that you can support family and transition to some other type of programming. And we're seeing people choose all sorts of different models. And we think that's fantastic because all of those are going to support kids to grow up in family, right? Just like my kids need medical services, your kids, so do kids in sub-Saharan Africa or Haiti or wherever. And you know, they need the education services, right? Right now we're all in a pinch because our kids are home, you know, and that makes it more difficult, you know, being in lockdown. When I have education services for my kids and they can go to a school or a tutoring center, that strengthens me as a parent, right? So there's really a number of different things that people can transform to, and, yeah, and we can walk people through that and help them as they make those decisions.
Yeah, the work you guys are doing is so inspiring and transformational. It's the reason why I love what you guys do is that it's moving the needle, you know, in terms of family preservation, in terms of reunification. And I'm willing to bet that we have listeners because we have a big audience that listens to this podcast. And one of the recurring questions we get is how can we jump in? How can we get involved? So talk a little bit about how our audience can support 1 million home. Like how do we jump onto this train, man?
Yeah. Well, the thing is the tide is shifting. So even as you had asked earlier, the pushback is lessening. Like people are saying, yeah, we do want kids and family.
Yeah. It's like an awakening.
We want to see that too. We want to help people see that it is attainable and there are organizations doing good work. I was on a call, my call before this one. We were talking with an organization in Haiti who are partners of ours that are finishing their transition, another partner in Lesotho that is finishing their transition. So, I mean, it's happening. It's happening. It's feasible. It's possible. So how can people get involved? If you go to 1millionhome.com, you're going to see a little tab there that just says take action. And you're also going to see the areas that we're engaged through partnership. We are all about radical collaboration. So we do everything in partnership. So we have national accelerators, which is basically saying we're going to take this country on and we're going to transform care in this particular area. And for this year, 2021, we have 5 national accelerators. You guys can go on there and just say, hey, I want to be a part of care reform in Haiti or Thailand or, Uganda, whatever. You can go on there and just, give a donation or get your church engaged. I think that's another great way. If we have people that, we talk about the evangelical population, I count myself among them, that have been supporting orphanages, but they say, well, I would want kids to have family too, or like, I think I could learn something here. Just reach out to us, go onto the website. You can email me. I'll give my email out on broadcast. I don't care. Brandon@1millionhome.com. That's the number one. So use the numeral. We would love to hear from you guys. So that would be 2 ways. Definitely come out and see what we're doing on the website. See the places that we're engaged. Think about donating. Check out who our partners are that are working really throughout. I mean, we got from Western Hemisphere all the way to Southeast Asia. We have really fantastic people that we're working from, and supporting us is supporting that work. You'll see project cards on there where people can donate to specific projects. So there's a lot of ways. So yeah, you can definitely donate. Yeah. If you're a praying person, pray and reach out to us if you have an orphanage that you think could learn how to transform to something else.
Yeah. I was going to say real quick, if you're listening right now and you're like, oh man, what was that email address again? We will, if you jump over to honestlyadoption.com/podcast, you click on this particular show, this particular interview, we're going to include the links to 1 million home there, your social media. Plus, now that you freely gave your email out on air, which is brave, I must say. Kudos to you.
It's my work.
I will
email.
Now
it's
also.
Not my personal.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. We'll make sure that that's on there too, so people can have direct access. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Well, Brandon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. We have so much to think about and learn from here. And I know our listeners are going to appreciate this conversation as much as Mike and I did.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate what you guys are doing to support adoptive families and families that are reunification track as well. There's so many things that I know we could talk about maybe another time. I'm an adoptive dad and have just appreciated what you guys do.
Thank you for listening to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a resource courtesy of the Honestly Adoption Company. To learn more about us, visit www.honestlyadoption.com.